Yes, I think we walked like 130 miles back and forth and never got to ski, but learned a lot of lessons and we got to see a lot of the Karakoram along with El Toro and the sights of the Trango Towers and Mitre Peak and Broad Peak and K2 and the Gasherbums and all the peaks we saw. There's so many lines that I'd love to go back and so many lessons I learned that would set me up for success the next time.
Hello and welcome to the Duffel Shuffle. I'm Adrian Ballinger, and we're here to discuss the world of climbing and skiing in all its forms through the eyes of mountain guides.
And I'm Sam Kiekeffer. In each episode, we'll unpack exhilarating stories, share invaluable insights, and get up close and personal with some of the most experienced and passionate guides and athletes in the industry.
Whether you're a seasoned alpinist or a weekend warrior, the Duffel Shuffle is your ticket to the thrilling world of climbing, skiing, and mountaineering. Join us. Oh boy, we're back. Welcome everyone to the Duffel Shuffle, episode 3. Sam, it's nice to see ya.
You as well. We're back. We're doing this. It's going well, mostly.
What are you up to today?
You know, just getting some life stuff done. It's a life day for me.
I love life days. I mean, sometimes I love life days and sometimes I hate them. I had kind of a cool one yesterday, kind of in the sprint to leaving for Tibet and Everest. And yesterday I went and got my first ever U.S. passport. I think a lot of people don't know, but I actually have not been a U.S. citizen for the past 42 years living here. I've been on a green card. I've tried many times to get my citizenship and always failed because I'm traveling out of the country so much and keep getting kicked out of the system. Well, having Arrow, I finally got to be in the country, did my whole naturalization process, interviews, lots of fun stuff, got naturalized a couple of weeks ago down in Sacramento, and then had to race down and get an urgent emergency passport in San Francisco in order to be able to leave for China in a few days, and it all worked. I got a passport.
Of course, it happened like right before you're about to leave for China, one of the more difficult countries for us to go to.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely have been thinking about the process, but I didn't actually expect my naturalization would happen within weeks of leaving. And all of a sudden, all the ways I've traveled for the past 40 years went out the window and I had to start from scratch. But it's been exciting. It's all working. So that's I guess that's my news, but why don't we talk about the news?
Awesome. Well, I think the big news for us is the Outdoor Recreation Act that just passed in the House of Representatives. Still needs to go through the Senate, but really big news, bipartisan act that you know a little bit about.
Yeah, so the act is actually a number of acts all grouped together. I guess that's how this usually works. I think most people are calling it the Explore Act that passed the House, but it also includes the Park Act, which is specific to climbing and anchors in wilderness. And then there's something called the SOAR Act. And, you know, as I've started researching or kind of following along the process of this going through committee and eventually being approved, there's lots in there that I don't necessarily love. And I think when I talk to friends, different people pull out different things and they're like, I don't like this. I hate this. But I think that's kind of when you have an act that's hundreds of pages and reaching many different constituents, that's something that we need to maybe accept and is the whole better than not having the whole. And so for me, looking at this act, essentially it's like the most important piece of outdoor recreation laws that's come through Congress in years. And so I'm overall very excited about it because the goal is to make it easier for more people to access experiences in the outdoors. And that's what I've spent my whole life and career trying to encourage. So overall, big picture, I'm pretty excited about it. And specifically to Alpenglow Expeditions and to mountain guiding, my sort of area of expertise, the SOAR Act directly is going to make what we do hopefully more accessible.
Yeah, I think the SOAR Act is kind of representative of the whole wrapped up act, in that they're just trying to make things easier. And, you know, since COVID happened, there's been an increase in outdoor recreation. No one can argue that. And simplifying these processes and also protecting these environments a little bit better, and not protecting them by constraining them, but protecting them while also simplifying access, is awesome. And the SOAR Act, I'm personally pretty excited about as well.
Yeah, so, and that's right on, right? We know there are challenges as we make it easier for more people to go outside, that sometimes it feels like areas are being overly impacted. So of course, any increase in accessibility needs to go along with like a strong, smart management plan that focuses on things like leave no trace and not impacting the areas we're in any more than absolutely necessary. Specifically, the SOAR Act, like, it kind of, we were joking before we went online, the challenges of getting permits to be able to mountain guide. Now, I think of mountain guiding, you know, taking people outside climbing and skiing in the backcountry, to be incredibly low impact. But for many years, permitting climbing, outdoor guiding on public lands has been similar to permitting mining or logging or grazing on public lands, which are much, much higher impact. And so one of the goals of the SOAR Act is to simplify the permitting for low impact recreational activities, allowing commercial guiding. And I believe commercial guiding on public lands to be incredibly important. Not everyone has the experience to go out and rock climb or ski on their own. So it's a very important place for mountain guides to be able to take people to these places and teach them not only how to experience the places safely, but also how not to impact them for other users. So I want to see increased guiding capacity, and I want it to be more easily accessible to more people. Like, I could tell you, for Alpaglow Expeditions, it took, you know, the first, let's see, 15 years of Alpaglow's life, I alone, and then I with my business partner Logan, spent, you know, years basically lobbying public landowners to allow us to offer climbing and backcountry skiing, and were just told no for years and years and years, despite being AMGA certified, being low impact and leave no trace, having a fantastic safety reputation around the world. I could guide on the tallest mountains around the world. I could guide on the incredibly technically terrain in Europe, but I couldn't guide anywhere in the United States for the first, I think, 14 years of Alpaglow Expeditions' existence. And that is not how I think the system should work.
Yeah, I mean, I feel very fortunate coming into Alpaglow and working for Alpaglow. We have an incredible list of permits, and we're able to guide in an incredible, you know, list of areas. But one, I know the legwork that takes on an annual basis for the company to establish and maintain. And two, there's a lot of areas that I think a little bit of commercial guiding would actually benefit that area, from, you know, trailhead etiquette, parking, to, you know, on trail or on skin track etiquette, you know, leave no trace related. I think having professional mountain guides in the area doesn't really have any sort of negative impact. If anything, it just has a positive impact. And certainly I'm a little biased, but, you know, we're trying to help people enjoy these areas responsibly. And a lot of what I do is not actually the risk management side of it. It's the etiquette, and it's enjoying these places responsibly. Certainly there's the risk management part, but that's a smaller portion than I think people recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're so right. Like, not only etiquette, that having guides out might help others to see other teams on mountains and things like that, but also when there is an incident, we know it's hard perhaps for, you know, National Forest employees or California Highway Patrol to get quickly to an incident. It's often what I've seen around the world on mountains is it's mountain guides who help non-guided teams when there are incidents, at least in that first stage of stabilization and figuring out what an incident, you know, response is going to be, and then bringing in professional search and rescue teams or whatever it might be. And so I think that is another good reason there aren't enough federal employees on public lands, but mountain guides can provide some of the same resources in those places. And the last thing I'd say, you know, of course, we're kind of on the same side of this issue, being both mountain guides and wanting to be able to guide more. You know, while we do have an incredible list of permits, there are so many places I wish Alpenglow could take our clients. I wish we could go to Yosemite with our clients. I wish we could go to Mount Rainier or the Tetons with our clients. We've been trying for years to be able to guide around Vegas with our clients, and those things just aren't an option currently. And you know, while the SOAR Act is not going to transform things overnight, I like the idea that they're trying to simplify and loosen some of the challenges. But the biggest argument against this that I hear is either one, just anti-commercialization. Anything that makes money is bad. If you don't make money, it's good. I think anytime money comes into the picture, of course, we need to make sure that things are properly regulated to make sure there's a high level of quality and safety in the product, which certainly I think the SOAR Act will continue to support, sort of, you know, guide companies with the proper insurance and the proper training and things like that. And then the second thing is that, of course, you know, some people are just afraid that they don't want any more people in their playgrounds. We hear that locally here in Tahoe a lot as trailheads get busier, as snow gets skied out more quickly. You get a little bit of that like surfer mentality, or at least that's what I always think of it as a beginning Gumby surfer going to Santa Cruz and getting, you know, yelled at and threatened and things like that. Like there's a little bit of that on the edges of, I think, outdoor of climbing and skiing. And I just want to consistently push back against that I don't ever want to see that mentality enter our sports. We should be encouraging people, you know, to have best etiquette, like you mentioned, but I don't think we should be closing the gates to things that have been such positive experiences in our lives. And any local who loves backcountry skiing or climbing, they know the good that is done in their lives. And I think we should be encouraging more people to have those experiences. Mountain guides help to do that in the best way possible. And strong locals, we're always going to be able to go further and deeper than a mountain guide with their introductory backcountry 1.0 ski trip or their Airy level 1 course or their intro to rock climbing course. I just don't think it's true that additional guiding and teaching people the best ways to experience these places are going to negatively impact experienced users' experience.
No, I mean, newsflash, the people are there already. these trailheads are as busy as they've ever been. And that secret stash that you used to go to in the 80s is no longer secret because we have, you know, all these resources around the internet, guidebooks, et cetera. So I agree with you. I think that is not the right mentality and they're already there. And it's much more enjoyable when, you know, they're using a wag bag and packing out their poo and they're, you know, parking well and not parallel parking when you can park perpendicular and, yeah. So we're on the same page for sure.
We're also in this, I mean, the US from, you know, obviously you go to Europe quite a bit and you travel quite a bit for climbing. I travel all over the world, you know, 1.5 of the year, each year for climbing and skiing. And like, we are probably the single most restrictive country on the planet to mountain guiding and, commercial use, you know, professionals bringing recreational users into the backcountry. That's not wrong. That's how the US has developed to really protect its wilderness and its outdoor resources. That's very important. And I don't think we should change that character, but I am very excited to see a little bit of loosening, a little bit of increasing access. And I think there's a really great conversation, which this act sort of peripherally is involved in, but you know, the larger issue of what is wilderness versus what is our other outdoor public lands. And I really see this differentiation to be very important. I do think wilderness regulations for everything from commercial use to fixed anchors should look completely different than public lands in general. And having very rigid rules around wilderness, I think, will help to protect the special character the United States has, the very few other developed countries in the world have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we could continue to talk about the pros and cons of this for a long time, but it's an exciting step forward. I think you and I are both just excited that this is being discussed and it's moving forward. We're making progress and it's going to the Senate. So we'll see what happens.
You stay tuned.
Awesome. Well, that wraps up our news, and we'll talk to you shortly with a great guest for episode 3.
Let's go. Today's podcast is brought to you by Alpenglow Expeditions, a Tahoe-based guide company with an international reputation. In its 20th year of operations, Alpenglow leads the highest quality expeditions in some of the world's greatest mountain ranges, from California's High Sierra to the rugged Himalaya. Alpenglow runs more than 40 international expeditions per year, as well as offering a full menu of guided ski and climbing courses throughout California. Join us and experience the Alpenglow difference.
All right, welcome back to the Duffel Shuffle podcast. Today's guest is Caroline Gleick. Caroline, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat with you guys.
Awesome. So for those that don't know Caroline is a ski mountaineer. She's a big mountain 8,000 meter climber. She's a climate advocate. And most recently, she's announced she's running for a Senate seat in Utah. So lots to talk about with Caroline here. We want to kind of kick it off. You know, Caroline, I first heard about you, I want to say in maybe 2015, when you were the first female, and I believe fourth person ever to ski the complete Shooting Gallery book, a list of ski mountaineering lines in the Wasatch. Was that around 2015? Is that ever accurate?
I finished it in 2017. So
yeah, all right. Well, yeah. I must have heard when you were in the process. So you started out, you know, as a technical ski mountaineer at reasonably low elevations compared to what you've done since then. And then you moved on to some bigger mountains around the world, most notably in the Himalaya. As a ski mountaineer, what kind of drove you to attempt the Shooting Gallery?
Yeah, working on the Shooting Gallery, it was a really gratifying 5-year-long project, but I would say it was almost more like a decade and a half long project because I moved to Utah when I was 15 years old, right after my half brother was killed in an avalanche, and he was killed in Stairs Gulch, which is one of the lines in the Shooting Gallery. So my family moved shortly after he passed away and his wife was pregnant with their first child. And I picked up my first copy of the Shooting Gallery shortly thereafter, and I read this description of Stairs Gulch as a ski line, and I felt this intense, like, emotional attraction, but also this fear about the whole project, but especially about that line. And I find that is a common theme in my life. It's like this attraction mixed with the fear, you know? I tend to gravitate towards those things that deeply scare me. But that's kind of where it started. And then I was really, really scared about dying in an avalanche because I saw firsthand what that did to my family and how it just, you know, creates this tear in the fabric of your family that can never be repaired. So I didn't want to put my parents through that same pain of losing someone. So I took a long time working on my skills and saving up to buy my Avi gear and to take Avi courses. And I worked at gear shops and I was a ski coach and a ski nanny. And I did whatever I could to make it work to get that training and then slowly progressed. And then I think the other part of my motivation for doing the Shooting Gallery and wanting to be a skier and a mountaineer is just that I'm really short and I just wanted to see what the world looked like from the top of those peaks, you know, because I rarely ever get the bird's eye view. I'm always like at people's shoulder height. And so I just wanted to see what the world could look like from up high. And I think that's another part of my motivation still to this day is that it feels good when you're on the top of a mountain and everything is all small in the distance.
I love that. There's this very physical thing that you feel in the mountains where you're like, I am the tallest thing around right now. That's really fun.
I think it's cool too. You know, you move to this range and so many people as a high level skier leave their home range and go explore elsewhere. And you really focused in on the Wasatch. You focused in on this area with a high concentration of technical ski mountaineering lines. And, you know, the book that Andrew McLean wrote has a very long list of those lines. And you just said, I'm going to do all of them. And so that's pretty cool to just like be at home and really challenge yourself, you know, from the house every day.
Yeah, I mean, in the Wasatch too, you can just see so many of the lines from the valley floor or while you're driving up the canyon. So it's easy to get really obsessed with them, and you're looking at them all the time and they're looking at you and they're like, come ski me. But the other part of it was like a financial decision, and it was about, you know, it was a practical decision because when I was building my ski career, it's really tough to make a living as a pro skier. Like the first couple years, I mean, the first decade or so, I'm really grateful for my Clif Bar sponsorship because that was a lot of my calories, you guys. Like I was subsisting on a thin margin, and I always wanted to travel the world and climb and ski the biggest mountains, but I simply didn't have the kind of financial resources or backing to make those to make an international trip happen. And so part of it is like the Midwestern frugality and just that family ethic of not spending more than you earn and making sure to run a tight budget. And I always wanted to go to the Himalayas, and I was always trying to figure out a way to make it happen. But it took until I was in my 30s that I had enough savings and that I had the resources and the kind of, you know, support from sponsors too, to make those bigger trips happen.
And before we turn to those Himalayan expeditions, when was it in the process of skiing the lines in the shooting gallery where you went from trying to choose specific lines that you were interested in to, I want to ski all of them? Like, was there a moment when you shifted?
It's an interesting question because I've been inspired by like alpinists and Patagonia alpinists, right? That are all about not spraying down about your accomplishments and not putting your goals out. It's like this, a lot of the people that really inspired me and that were my close kind of examples or people who are deeply inspiring to me, they were not about like putting out a goal like that before you had actually achieved it. And so I think I was always a little bit cautiously optimistic and reluctant. And I was always just taking it one day, one line at a time, because I never wanted the goal or the public pressure or any of those things to influence my decision making. And you see that so often as a risk factor in the mountains, when people have a list or they have the expectation of achieving an objective, and it leads people to make bad decisions in the mountains. And so my first priority was always to come home in one piece with all my fingertips, toes, nose, you know, all the ligaments intact. And I think it was only once I got really close to the end that I was like, I'm going to finish this and I'm going to do it. But I think it's also just maybe partially to being a woman, and that I didn't want to appear like overconfident, or there's a lot of research that shows that women wait until they're like 100 or over 100% qualified to do something before they, like a job, for example, like women wait until they're overqualified, whereas men will apply when they're at 60%. Mm. And I think for me, it was ski mountaineering. That was a good thing. Like, it's good to build your mountain sense slowly and to ease into things before you get into the big mountains. Sometimes in retrospect, I think I could have pushed a little harder, a little faster. But this was before, too, the time of like everything on Strava. Like, we had to, like, some of the lines, they used to be hard to find. Like, they would take multiple attempts. It was not what it is today. So it was a little bit of a different time. The gear was heavier, the routes were more tricky, and the backcountry, it was a different place in 2015, 2017 than it is today. And so I think it's still good to sort of have that balance in how you approach the big mountains and to build yourself up slowly and to not jump into it. But then I'm like, oh, maybe I should have gone in a little faster. And like, you know, I probably could have done it fast or whatever it is. I don't know. It's always hindsight's 20/20. I'm happy the way that I did it.
Absolutely. And it's such a big part of your career to this point has been sort of inspiring other people to try these things, right? And to step outside of their comfort zones and to attempt bigger things, set up dreams, figure out the skills that it takes to have those dreams, and then go out and accomplish them. Are you seeing a lot more people since you skied the shooting gallery in 2017? Is there a lot more people trying to ski the lines? And actually, has another woman skied all of the lines yet?
Yes, I think two seasons ago, the second woman finished. So there's two women now. And I think the third one is getting close to being done. So I'm hoping, I need to get out with her one of these days and help her finish it off. But there's definitely been a lot more people that are not only trying to tick the lines in the shooting gallery, but just the level of froth and excitement. And it's great to see how people are turning to the mountains and how people are getting so into it. But it does worry me a little bit, just kind of the cut and paste style that we see where one person opens a line and the next day a ton of people do it. And I get it. It's like, it's easy to do that. But I just also hope that people are taking care to learn about the snow conditions and the changing, because snow is such a different element like that. I mean, rock climbing or trail running, I think you have less variability in how quickly a route can change. But with snow, it can even be an hour, even a half an hour can make all the difference from being able to ski something safely or doing it in a way that puts other people or infrastructure at risk. And so I don't want to be like the old guard or the curmudgeon who's like, all these people now are getting it, you know, just cut and paste alpinism. At the same time, I just do want to, I want people to remember Martin, my half brother, and to remember that their decisions can have big consequences on those around them, and to make sure that they're taking care and making good decisions in the mountains so they can come home safe.
Absolutely. I think it's a great message and something we, you know, as mountain guides and people who love playing in the mountains, you know, we think about a lot, is like how to invite as many people as we can into these incredible experiences that I know have changed me so much, more for the better than the worse. And so therefore I want to encourage other people to have these experiences. And yet at the same time, like where that line is, I think you and I have even talked about it a little bit in the past. It's like where that line is of inviting everyone and making sure we're not gatekeeping, but at the same time, reminding people there are still very real risks to these activities, to themselves, to their partners, to other users in the environment, and then to the environment itself. And I don't know how all those pieces fit together and where the balance is. I imagine you living in the Wasatch, especially where it's such a concentrated playground with so many people, do you see a lot of those conversations happening? Are you partaking in a lot of those conversations of how to encourage people to play outside on these places responsibly?
I'm a big donor and funder for the Utah Avalanche Center, and I try to support and amplify their message whenever I can. And they do a really good job in terms of getting the message out there. And they've particularly been leading on using video and incorporating video into their messaging. And so I think they're doing an amazing job. And I 100% support their work and them as a messenger. And I think that in the Wasatch and in some of the Western states in general, that I wish that there were more permit days available, particularly for mountain guides to help train people, because there's just not enough
gospel. Like,
yes. I mean, we need the U.S. Forest Service to reform some of the permitting so that they can get more days guiding people. And we need to change this like anti-guide sentiment that I feel sometimes in the Wasatch, because there is nothing wrong with hiring a guide to help you achieve your goals. And especially when it comes time to training specific skills that you're going to use, that you want to use to be more independent. It can be hard to get into some of these classes. It can be hard to make it work with your schedule, with the availability. And while organizations like ARI and, you know, other orgs do a good job of having those classes, if you're looking for specific skills or to get the most bang for your buck, I highly recommend hiring a certified mountain guide to help you get those skills. So it's a tool in our toolkits that I feel is really being underutilized here in the Wasatch. And I would love to see more people embrace that as an educational tool.
Caroline, kind of speaking on that, I know throughout your career, you've worked alongside a lot of guides, whether they're doing safety for film crews that you're skiing in front of or, you know, in the Himalaya. How is your process both similar and different to the process of those guides that you've worked alongside and observed through your career?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of my inspiration for wanting to work with guides came from my partnership with my friend, the late Liz Daly, who is a professional snowboarder, a split boarder, and she was training to become a certified mountain guide. And I felt like I had to do a lot of work to build my skill set to be on par with hers. And when we were in the mountains together, she was my best friend. She just like showed me this path that you can be feminine, you can be a strong leader. So, I think that's a good question. I mean, one of the things I think in the mountain culture in general that is different from my style is like just the attitude about leadership. And I think sometimes there's still this like, there can be this masculine machismo energy that's this certain style of leadership that is about telling people, and it's not about like as much the public input or making decisions in collaboration. And I think that my style is a little bit, my process is more like putting everything out on the table, openly sharing my doubts and fears, and then addressing those things individually. And so like, I'm an over communicator and I'm like the TMI kind of person. And so it depends on the person. Like sometimes that works with different leadership styles. Sometimes it doesn't work as well. But at the end of the day, I think that there's definitely a strength in being able to kind of be vulnerable and to express your fear and your emotion, because a lot of the stuff we do is really scary and it's okay to be scared by it. Like I'm still scared by the things that I do. And sometimes I look back at the things that I've done and I'm like, I still feel that imposter syndrome. How did I do that? Who was that person? That wasn't me. Like, I'm terrified. So I guess it's like, it's okay to be afraid and to do it anyway. And it's okay to share your fears. And I think that there's a strength and a power in that as well.
Awesome. I love that message. I'm scared all the time. And it is funny. If you get any group of mountain athletes together who are in their 30s or older, I think most will admit to being shocked that they survived some of their experiences of their younger, you know, career. And I think it's an interesting thing to see throughout the industry. It's like, one, well, you know, thank God so many of us have made it through. Number two, how can we share these stories to that next generation? You know, so maybe they don't have to make as many mistakes as we did. But then at the same time, I also think it's important to own and acknowledge like different risk tolerances are okay. And, you know, so, sometimes that level of invincibility that comes early in our careers, I think also leads to some of the wildest accomplishments in our sport. So I'm on that like thing too. You mentioned not being a curmudgeon before. I like sometimes get worried that I sound curmudgeonly to like some of the young guides and skiers and climbers that I spend a lot of time with. I'm like, oh, I need to figure out how to like share my experiences and my fear of like how easy it is to get killed in the mountains and still be totally open to like the magic of it, of going out there and like trying wild things.
Well, it's interesting, Caroline, you were talking about the kind of copy paste nature of our society this day and age. And, you know, so much of my learning has come from the near misses or the observing other people having accidents in the mountains. And, you know, the equipment, the information online has allowed us to really plug and play this day and age in a different way than, you know, when we started. And, you know, I'm sitting here in Shasta, actually on a drive to the North Cascades, staring up at Shasta, and Shasta is where I had one of my most early mountain experiences. And I was like altitude sick, dehydrated, sunburnt to like a bubbling level. But I learned so much. And how do you learn through the near misses or the experiences while also staying safe? And it's kind of this double-edged sword a little bit. If you don't have any of those experiences, you don't actually develop your own skills and understanding. But at the same time, we want to keep people safe in the mountains. It's a complicated environment.
I think it is complicated. But on the other hand, I mean, one of the great lessons I've learned from watching someone like you, Adrian, is like, it's okay to turn around and it's okay to fail. It's okay to back off if it doesn't feel right. I mean, it took you what, 3 tries to ski Makalu? Is that right? Mm-hmm.
That is right. Yeah.
Yes. I follow all this stuff. And I'm a total geek and I think the more we can share those stories about turning around and backing off when it doesn't feel right, that's better. And to have pride in the mountains we didn't climb, the expeditions where we didn't summit, but we came home safe, those stories are just as important as the ones that were successful. And they can feel a lot harder to share, but it's super important that we share those times that we turned around, because maybe just something didn't feel right. Or it could just be a weird feeling you had. It could be you didn't feel acclimatized. It could be that you got really sick, you threw up 30 times, you had to be carried by the porters, and then your partner was unable to make it to the toilet on time and unable to get the diarrhea under control to a point that they could leave base camp. And so all of those things are valid. And it could, yeah, and it could just be an intuition feeling. But the more that I think we can share and normalize turning around because something was off, I think the better. Because, a lot of times when people have an accident or there was a fatality, they will say, not the fatalities, but the accidents. I've heard people share, like, my heart wasn't in it that day, or I just didn't want to be there, but I went anyway. And so it can be hard when you have put a lot of time and money into an expedition to turn around, when you've walked 70 miles to a base camp and all you want to do is to put your skis on and make some turns. But sometimes things just don't line up, and that's okay. The mountain will be there and you can go back and try again.
Absolutely. Well, I'm remembering some of your Himalayan experiences and stories as you hit on those points. So maybe we'll shift a little bit to the Himalaya. But I did, you know, one of the things I thought about the background you were talking about in the Wasatch, like how a lot of people, you don't want to spray, and so you don't want to tell people about your dream or goal until like you're almost done with it or finished with it. That has been a tradition in our sport for so long. I actually think there's a perfectly valid reason for doing that, but I also think it can be to the detriment of people's larger understanding that we do actually fail so much of the time, and those failures can still be so meaningful because, you know, if we don't tell about the experience until we're done, then I think we get to cherry pick kind of like our successes and like how it worked out and why it worked out the way we did. One of the things I think you've been really good about in your career is you do tell a story from beginning to end. And if it doesn't work out, everyone sees it not work out in real time or close to real time. And I've always endeavored to do that as well. And I think it's a vulnerable place to put yourself in, but I do think maybe that can help as people are getting into this sport, kind of seeing how many of those failures happen. I think in ski films, it's often been really hard to see, right? Everyone sees, you know, of course, there's like one little 30-second crash reel, but the rest of the film is all about nailing the lines, but it's not all about all the work that went into and all the days that we're just sitting around waiting to get it right to nail the line. And that's the part of the story that I actually like find fascinating.
Yes, I agree completely. And I think from the shooting gallery and not being like super public with the goal from the beginning. And that was like, I worked on that project from 2012 to 2017, but now it's 2024. It's like definitely a lot more to the culture to put the goals out on the table. And I think I have a lot more confidence now too. It takes a lot more confidence to be able to do that. And so once you have those wins, it's easier to put it on the table and to know how to spin the narrative or to own it when it doesn't work out. Yeah. But it still kind of hurts when it doesn't go to plan. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, my ego is still a little bruised from Pakistan and Aconcagua. I've had a couple failures lately.
Well, they're all part of the process. But yet, you know, one of the things Sam and I spoke about that we were really interested in, and I'm not sure I remember, like, what was it? What was that shifting point where you were like, okay, I'm a really good ski mountaineer. I've done all these lines in Utah. I'm sure you've been to lots of other places in the States and Canada and Europe. But then you began going to sort of what I would call extreme altitudes, the highest mountains in the world, the Himalaya. Like, what triggered that? Or was it a dream all along? Why did you decide you were ready? What brought you to the Himalaya?
That's a great question. I mean, I think just growing up and reading alpinists, cutting out those pictures of the different lines drawn on the mountains. And then I majored in anthropology at the University of Utah, and I've always been fascinated by not just the physical and mental challenges of climbing mountains, but the cultural challenges too. And to be able to travel the world and to see the world through that lens of having this objective of climbing the mountain, I think it brings people together in a very unique way. And just, I think I was really intrigued by the cultural challenge and the I still, like, some of my favorite memories are touring the Potala Palace in Lhasa and driving through the desert and the dusty mountains of Tibet on the way to Choi Yu and Everest Base Camp. And there's a romanticism. There's a way that we romanticize it that maybe is not 100% culturally accurate because it's a complicated situation. But it's just the heart wants what the heart wants. That was what I always wanted. I don't know where I got it in my head, but I think also maybe it was growing up at the time I did. You know, I'm 38 now. And so growing up, it was kind of the golden era of ski mountaineering when a lot of those lines were first being skied, like by the Kasha Rigbys and the Hillary Nelsons and the generation that went before me, Kit Deloria, you know, the list goes on. But that could be another part of it. It's just that it was that golden era of ski mountaineering. And that was what I grew up fascinated with.
Yeah, absolutely. So I remember you went and you skied a bunch of peaks in Ecuador, I think. And that was like a stepping stone, if I remember right.
Yes.
And then you ended up on Choyu as your first 8,000 meter peak.
That's right. We did Peru also.
Oh, all right.
And you gave me a bunch of beta for Peru, which we really appreciated. And we wanted to ski a lot of things in Peru, but we were a little bit early in the season there. And the snow conditions were quite touchy. So we still skied a couple different, 18 and 19,000 foot peaks. And we had Alfredo as our base camp chef. And he was awesome.
He is the best. Shout out to Alfredo and his pancakes.
Shout out to Alfredo and his amazing cooking, the lomo saltado. And Peru was a great stepping stone. Ecuador was a great stepping stone. I did a lot of big lines in Chamonix. And just to be in such a, I skied like the West Couloir, the Chardonnay, and climbed it via the Forbes Arete and did a bunch of big classic lines in Chamonix. So all of those things were stepping stones. And then I think my partnership with Rob was a big reason that we went to Choyu. For my birthday, he gave me a little laminated picture of Choyu and he put the deposit down for the trip.
Amazing.
So it was Rob, like his instigation, because like for me, I'm always like, how are we going to afford that? How are we going to pay for it? Like my rational brain and my frugalness is like, that's going to be too much money. You know, we can't spend that much money to do that. But it was Rob and he was like, we're going. And that partnership with Rob, with my partner, and he had climbed Denali and Aconcagua before I met him. And then he got really into backcountry skiing. And so he wanted to go to Everest. I didn't know that I wanted to go to Everest, but but I did want to go to Choyu. So we were going to go to Cho and then he, as a training for Everest. And then when we were driving to Choyu, I got the first glimpse of Everest. And it was particularly caked with snow in the post-monsoon season. And I was like, I have
that to thing is that skiable.
Mountain. That thing, it looks so good. Oh my gosh, if only. And that was the year that Hillary and Jim were on Lhotse and they skied the Lhotse Couloir. So it was a really good snow year.
It was a special snow year. That makes a lot of sense. It's funny. I mean, from the skiing I've tried to do over there and have done, it's just so much of it is luck of being there in a season and at a time and being healthy and with the mountain and it kind of like set up when those conditions come. And it can take seasons on seasons, like we were joking about Makalu, me taking three tries. You know, when I did go to Everest and Lhotse in 2013 on the south side to try to ski it with the Russian skier Sergei Baranov, and we just had blue ice from bottom to top. And it's like, it takes a lot of luck, takes a lot of time being there. But so, so I remember those, some stories from your expeditions. Obviously, we were on Everest together. Choyu, I wasn't there when you were there. Did these big mountains, were they what you expected? What surprised you? And I'd throw Gashabram into that as well. You know, you've now climbed in all of, you know, in a variety of the biggest peaks in the world.
Oh my gosh, it's some of my favorite and my least favorite memories of my life, both at the same time. Like, so many things can be true at once, right? It's like the fear and the love, the fascination, the there's a lot more walking on rocks than I thought.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot less skiing. The snow lines were so high. I was really, it's not a great place if you want to ski. Like, you could go on a much better ski vacation. Like, if you want to go ski, go like on the
Go Antarctic. Anywhere else.
Yeah, go anywhere else. Because you don't get that much skiing, and the skis are actually just kind of a liability. They're heavy and they add all this extra stuff you need to bring. That's such a deep question. There's so many different things. The pain of acclimatizing, I'm terrible at high altitude every time.
And yet you've been totally successful. I think that's something to remember.
I pull it together on summit day. It together because the summit day is back when I'm in my element. It's like when we're on the snow and ice, that's where I'm happy. But then all those days leading up to it where you're just walking on endless talus or the dryness, the dust, those things were not, I don't think you expect it to be so dry and dusty.
You're just getting me so excited to be back there in 10 days, dry, dusty, walking on rocks. It's why for the past week, instead of going skiing corn, I've been forcing myself to go mountain running and hiking in terrible conditions, breakable crust and just relatively miserable, and telling myself that I really like this. But I think that's what I think of these big mountains is the people who end up excelling or doing well are people who are willing to just take on kind of low grade suffering for large amounts of time and feeling like a lot of things are actually out of their control and yet continuing to move forward when it's possible. Is that kind of how you experience the mountains?
Yes. And the waiting game, I think, is really a hard thing to explain because in our modern society in the United States, we're used to things happening like that. Like, you want overnight delivery on FedEx, you got it. You just pay for it, right? But in the Himalayas and the Karakoram, there's just some things that, you can't rush the Pakistani military approving your permit. You're just going to have to park your butt in Skardu and wait. And you're going to be subjected to these rolling blackouts in the 110 degree heat where your internet and your fan just goes out. And it's given me a much greater appreciation. The geopolitical part of it is really interesting to me, to be able to travel that way and to see and how these mountains, a lot of them are these border. They're the border. Everest is right on the border of Tibet and Nepal. And then Gashabram is right on the border with India. And so you get to go to these corners of the world that very few people have seen. And you get to see how people live in a really intimate way. And to me, that's probably the most beautiful and my favorite part of it is these unlikely alliances that you make with people, with Shakir Ali, one of our kitchen staff in the Karakoram. We ended up hiking out with him and spent many days together. And the way you can communicate, even not knowing that much of each other's language and the bonds that you develop, I think that's a really cool part. That's one of my favorite things. Or playing gin rummy with Panuru on Choyu, the card games, those moments where you're waiting. Those are my favorite parts, really. There's just so many things you go through. It's kind of like running for Senate. It's every 7 minutes your mood changes. It's good, bad, good, bad. You know, something great happens, something terrible happens. And the roller coaster, the constant, it's a heavy weight, the feeling your legs are concrete sometimes. And then it's just, it gives you a lot of good life lessons, though, the patience and the communication, the way of making bonds with people without speaking the language, the way the smile can just spread love. There's just so many things like that. I want to go back so bad. I know. I'm getting sad.
Well, I know you're on this really big, obvious climb, using that overused metaphor of the project that you have, running for Senate right now. But just to stay in the mountaineering skiing world for one more minute, right now, today, I guess two-part question. Number one, do you have any big mountain expeditions planned? And number two, if you were told to pick one tomorrow, where would you go?
Ooh, okay. I do not have anything currently planned. And if I could pick one tomorrow, That's a tough. I think it would be Antarctica to go to try to climb and ski Tyree.
Awesome. Because did you climb and ski Vinson?
We climb and skied Vinson, yeah. Okay. In 2021. Yeah, we got to ski a beautiful variation from the regular climbing route. And oh, I loved Antarctica. I want to go back so bad. But it could also be Pakistan. I really want to go back to Pakistan. I don't know why. It's like, again, the fascination with the things that it's my love of my own suffering, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you certainly have, I mean, unfinished business, right? Like in Pakistan, you did a lot of the suffering part of the expedition and didn't get to have a lot of the joy part of the expedition. Would that be a fair assessment?
That would be accurate. Yes, I think we walked like 130 miles back and mm-hmm. forth and never got to ski, but learned a lot of lessons and we got to see a lot of the Karakoram along the El Toro and the sights of the Trango Towers and Mitre Peak and Broad Peak and K2 and the Gasherbums and all the peaks we saw. There's so many lines that I'd love to go back and so many lessons I learned that would set me up for success the next time.
Yeah. Oh, we need a whole separate podcast on lessons from Caroline in Pakistan to help all of our future clients and climbers. But do they mostly, you know, boil down to hygiene and food and kind of like temperature and not getting sick? Or
we were really careful about the hygiene and everything. So I don't know. I mean, that's a whole
That was the right
episode.
Thing for you to say, considering you were on an Alpenglow expedition.
We were really careful about our hygiene, and we did a lot to prepare and did a lot to to try not to get sick. And I think you just have to be prepared to get sick. Mm-hmm. What Monica said, I mean, I love Monica, by the way. I want to give a shout out to Monica Pires, who's Alpenglow's high altitude doctor. And she will be a
guest sometime soon.
She is just a wealth of knowledge. But basically what she told me is that it takes our stomachs like 3 to 4 trips over there before we get adapted to whatever is in the whatever gut yep. bacteria, whatever it is that makes us so sick. So yep. I think you just have to, instead of like trying so hard not to get sick and then getting sick anyway, I think you just need to be prepared and then just be prepared to ride it out and have all the electrolytes and things.
Yep. And I'm right there with you, even though I've done just dozens of trips over there. I got the sickest I've been since I was, you know, 22 years old backpacking in India. When I went to K2 in Pakistan, whether it is just different bacterial flora and fauna or whatever it might be, I got so, so sick. So I, as you were going through your personal journey of sickness over there, I was like, oh, I have been there, like just hoping to not ruin the last pair of long underwear or whatever it might be getting to base camp.
Yes, that is definitely the place where you want 100% success rate is getting into the bathroom on time. That is the one place where you want it.
100% success rate. It's a good goal.
We have less than 100% success rate.
Totally. Let's see. Is Sam, technical difficulties in the truck at Weed, California?
Am I back? Oh, I think I'm back.
You're 100%.
Awesome. So yeah. Well, I know you guys talked a lot about the 8,000 meter world, and we talk a lot about 8,000 meter world on this podcast. So I kind of want to hear more about Caroline's current climb. Caroline, we'll start off with, you have been a climate advocate for many years now. You do a lot of work with POW. You're a Patagonia athlete that, you know, has been active through Patagonia. And now you're running for Senate. What kind of inspired you, or was there anything, any pivotal moment in your career that kind of caused you to engage in climate advocacy?
When in 2010, when I was getting ready to graduate from the University of Utah, after as I was getting close to graduation, I did a political internship for Ted Wilson, who was the governor of Utah's environmental advisor. And so Ted was also a legendary climber and did the first ascent of the Great White Icicle, which is a classic multi-pitch climb alpine ice route here in Little Cottonwood. So he was a real trailblazer in the climbing world and also in the political world. He ran for Senate actually in the 80s. Huh. And so Ted passed away last week, but Ted deeply inspired me to see that I have a bigger purpose outside of just being a skier and a mountaineer. He really inspired me to take my seat at the table, to bring people together, to find common ground. And his legacy of service and leadership. And yeah, I was very inspired by Ted. And it's easy, I think, sometimes for us to take it for granted that we can travel to places like Pakistan or China. But there's a lot of privilege really that goes into being able to have a passport and having a safe geopolitical atmosphere that allows us to go to those places. So I really have always felt that it was important for me to have a balance between my advocacy and my sport. Just because also the inspiration from my parents, they were like, it's not a job to be a professional athlete. Like, you have to do something that gives back to society. And I really believe that. I think that ethic of care and compassion from Ted, from my parents, it was just deeply ingrained in me from a young age. So I've stayed politically active and used my platform as much as I could over the years when it, you know. But then last spring, I did a candidate training where I did this like very intense all day long workshop with this organization called Utah Women Run that trains women on how to run for office. And over the summer, I met with a campaign management team and talked to them about what a campaign could look like. And then I was like, I'm not ready. I'm too young, you know. So flash forward to the first week of January, it was very close to the filing deadline, and they asked me if I would run for the U.S. Senate seat because there wasn't a strong Democrat who had stepped up to do it. So I felt called to service because I felt that Utah needed me to do this, America needed me to do this, and that I could use this opportunity to continue the platform and the message about taking action on the climate crisis and, you know, to change the narrative, really, because American politics is in a bad situation right now and we need new leaders to step up. So in this case, it wasn't something that I had been planning for years and years, but sometimes you pick your mountain and sometimes the mountain picks you. Sometimes you drive by that line and you're like, I have to go do that line. Like, that is the next line I'm going to ski, or that's the next mountain I'm going to climb. And so for me, this one kind of picked me. But at the end of the day, with everything on the line in this upcoming election, the attacks on women's rights and our freedom, and with the potential of, you know, just where everything is going, there's so much on the line for our environment, for our rights, for women, for everything. And so I feel like we all need to step up and do what we can to save democracy.
I have so many questions.
Me too. But you go first, AB.
First of all, yeah, like first I just want to say, like, I admire so much that leap that you've taken, and it seems to me to be the scariest, hardest, most self-exposing process you could possibly go through to run for office, especially national office, and. You know, I don't think there's been an example yet necessarily, at least in the professional outdoor athlete world, of someone who's kind of like rallied and gone for it and learned the lessons of what politics at this level takes. So first of all, just like kudos, and I'm fascinated in the journey, and I want to see your success, of course. And I'm excited to see how many people in the outdoor industry and sports and athletes are, you know, rallying behind you and saying, like, this is wild and it's cool, and let's see where Caroline takes this. So go you. I wanted to start there. And then I guess
I appreciate that. All those things you said are true about the exposure and the risk. And there's a lot on the line for me personally, but I am 110% committed. And again, it's like, I'm glad that I stepped up to run for a big seat like the U.S. Senate, because we need more young people. Like, the average age of America is 38, which is my age. The average age of Utah is 30, but the average age of the U.S. Senate is 68. It's like, I appreciate and respect I appreciate the perspectives of every generation, But right now, our Do Nothing Congress is failing us in so many different ways. We need the perspectives of young people and more women to advocate for our future. There's so much on the line.
Absolutely. So how has, you're now a few months into the process, like what does that process look like? Is it campaign events? Is it donor calls? Is it building a platform of positions? Like what is that process you're going through, and how has the response been thus far in Utah and nationwide?
Yeah, I mean, the day that I filed my candidacy, fundamentally, when you step into the space of being a federal candidate, like when you're a state level candidate, it's a little bit different and it's not as stringent. But being a federal candidate, there are so many rules with the FEC, and it is a little bit of a complicated space to navigate. Like sometimes I kind of feel like I'm in purgatory, like I'm neither here nor there. Like I'm in this in-between space where you're like not quite a private citizen, but you're not quite an elected official. So it's a little bit of a gray area. And there's definitely some questions that we're still working through with the lawyers and with legal, because there hasn't really been a precedent for someone like me to run. And I really hope that more people who make their living in this, I hope we can set a precedent that will create a path for more people who make a living in an untraditional way to be able to run and to keep their businesses while they do it. Right now, there's a lot up in the air with that. It's a little bit stressful, but it's going to be resolved. So we're working through it. We spend a lot of time working on messaging, policy, traveling around the state, meeting with voters, hearing from people. I've been to 10 Utah counties so far, and I have 19 more to visit. My personal goal with the campaign is to run a 5K and invite people to do it with me in every Utah county. So we're going to be planning that. And it's been quickly scaling our business that started with like just a few people. And now there's almost 30 people that are working for the committee to elect Caroline Gleick.
Wow.
So to get like, it's really interesting to be able to start small and then build it so big and then create systems that are going to sustain future growth and to scale. And then it's volunteer calls and it's everything. It's more than a full-time job. And I don't know how sitting members of Congress do this. This is, I think, part of the problem with our political system is that it is, you know, I'm probably working 60 hours a week doing this between like the weekends. You know, you don't really get a time, you don't get time off. So it's all that stuff. And then there's a lot of fundraising as well. So to run for a U.S. Senate seat, the average cost of a winning Senate race in 2018 was $15.7 million. So it's a lot of fundraising. Yeah.
Wow.
A lot of time on donor calls and it takes a lot of planning and coordination with the fundraising piece to run a competitive Senate race.
Yeah. I love that idea you mentioned. Sorry, Sam. I just love that idea of running a 5K in every county, because I do think, like, you know, some of my best meetings, it's so cliche-ish, but some of my best meetings are out like in the skin track or on a trail run. Like that's how I often do business or come up with new ideas with friends and things like that. And so to bring that, which I'm sure is very much true in your life, like that's how you connect with people often, is probably outside. To try to bring that into a political campaign, I would bet, is really unique and also powerful to show people these experiences.
We're doing a lot of things really different than the average political campaign, whether that's how we meet with people or how we fundraise. And while most of the competitors, a lot of the folks running on the Republican side, one of the front runners put $1.5 million of his own money into his campaign. And another one of them is really backed by PACs and super PACs. We are building our campaign from the ground up, and it's been a grassroots groundswell with just, we have almost 10,000 contributions, and the average donation size is $42.
Wow.
So it's a really different model. And I'm super excited about everything we're going to do with the campaign. And so the three pillars for our policies are families, freedom, and future. And so starting with families, we have to make sure that our Utah and our American economy works for everybody and that no one fears losing their home if they have a healthcare crisis. Mm. I mean, there's a huge housing shortage in Utah, and it's really driving up the cost of housing. And we've seen just a huge increase in people, the numbers of people experiencing homelessness. And the federal government does not have data on how many Americans are currently experiencing homelessness, the reasons that they experience homelessness, or how many people are on the brink of experiencing homelessness. And so one of my first priorities as Utah's next senator would be to establish a federal agency to start collecting data and understanding the reasons and the numbers of people experiencing homelessness. And then when it comes to families, it also... we need to do as much as we can. We need to care as much about the lives of children who are born as the politicians care about the unborn. Right now, there's a lot of focus on protecting the unborn. And I think we also need to make sure we're doing everything we can to support caregivers, both for children and for elder care, but anyone who's a caregiver. There's a real lack of resources and support for caregivers in our society. And it is unfathomable to me that in 2024, we still tolerate sending children to school when there are the risk with the risk of gun violence. Like my heart breaks for every family that sends their kids to school when there's when so often we have these mass shootings. I mean, it's like, why do we still tolerate this? So definitely advocating. The Utah legislature last session passed a law to equip more teachers with guns, which I think is just a disgusting response in when we should be banning assault style weapons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when there's a lot more I could say about what we would do for families.
But I appreciate you touching on each of these three pillars. So what's the third? What does it mean to you?
Freedom is the second. And so we'll fiercely defend our reproductive freedom and get the government to stop creeping around our doctor's office. Make sure that every person has the right, you know, to make those decisions with their doctor and free of government interference. And we also want to make sure that every American, regardless of their wealth or their political affiliation or religion, can use government as a problem-solving tool. So we'll fight things like the partisan gerrymandering that we've seen in Utah that dilutes the power of a vote and expand access so more people can vote to make voting easier. I think that Election Day should be a national holiday so that everybody can get to the polls. And when it comes to protecting our future, we will accelerate our transition to clean, renewable energy while supporting our legacy energy producing communities and to make sure they have good union paying jobs. And we will, one of the big issues here is the Great Salt Lake, the drying of the Great Salt Lake. We'll make sure that lake gets enough water and that it doesn't become a dust bowl and pollute the air for the 2 million people in the Salt Lake Valley. And then we'll also advocate for policies like 30 by 30 to protect 30% of nature by 2030 as a climate solution as well. That's the top level of our policy.
Top level. And, you know, one of the things I'm interested in is, you know, you're running to be one of two people to represent Utah, obviously. And, you know, Utah, I consider, and please correct me if I'm wrong, to have a more conservative sort of like viewpoint on many social issues. And like, how do you balance that? Like this, you know, agenda, which I think you and I probably agree on, you know, a lot of things you just spoke about. How do you balance that with people who maybe don't share those same views, or how do you bring them kind of onto the team, into the camp?
It's a great question. And I think at the end of the day, we're all disenchanted with partisan politics and with party lines. But I'm really excited to meet with voters across the state and to talk about the values that we share. Because I think at the end of the day, we really do share a lot of the same values. And I hope that people will keep an open mind, because Utah values are family values, and really a lot of them are democratic values. I hate to say this because I hate to put it through a partisan lens. Like, I don't feel like the whole thing with the party politics, it is a little bit frustrating sometimes. I don't like the groupthink mentality that it puts us in. And I really respect the leadership of the person whose job I'm trying to take, Senator Romney, who voted with his conscience and he wasn't afraid to go against the grain and to go to vote against party lines. And so I'm just excited to meet with people and explain the platform and invite them in. Because I think when we sit down and meet face to face, that there's a lot more than we agree on than we disagree on. And the other thing I would add to that is that Utah is changing really quickly. And I really think that Utah will be one of the next states to go blue. We call it Blue-tah.
Blue-tah.
It will be blue. We'll take it purple and blue. But to me, again, it's not about flipping the seat. It's not about Democrat versus Republican. This is about who we are as a people and the kind of America, the vision of America that we want to spread to the world. This is about leadership, and it is about, like, are we a people that are caring and loving and that have compassion and kindness in our hearts? Or are we an angry people that, like, lead with hatred and division? And so to me, it's really about those things. And the people that I know in Utah, they are kind, loving, open, tolerant. Like, the values of Utahns, really, we share the same values. And so I'm really excited to give people a great option in the poll at the polls in November.
I like what you said there. I think, you know, in my opinion, a lot of what U.S. politics struggles with is the bipartisan nature, because maybe there isn't the exact path for every voter. And have you found that in your developing your candidacy that the process is very bipartisan in nature, and therefore it's hard for someone who's trying to break down those kind of two-party lines? Like, is the process set up so that it's difficult and that's why you've chosen to run as a Democrat? Or do you think that that's just the best way to get your word out there?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, in terms of getting a pathway to having your name on a ballot, it really depends on the state that you're in. But for me, as a, like, it just makes the most sense. I think as an independent in Utah, you can also have, there's a nice pathway to get your name on the ballot. I think it's easier than other states. But definitely when I put down my values and things on paper, they are way more aligned with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party.
Yeah.
So, and I think running as an independent, it can, that there is definitely space for a third party. And I wish that we just didn't have parties at all. Like, I can't speak fully to the whole history and the reason things are the way they are. But for me, where I am, it definitely made more sense. And I'm more aligned with Democratic values, especially with where the Republican Party is going. I mean, it's truly terrifying. And the example that it sends to the rest of the world, the national embarrassment that the person that they are enabling at the top of the ticket, you know, a known criminal, someone who's openly bragged about sexually assaulting women. There's just, we kind of need to unite around, I don't want, like, providing an alternative and showing a different kind of leadership.
I really like what you said about, and I feel it really strongly as well through my guiding and teams that we work with and things like that, where it's so easy, of course, online, of course, on social media, to feel like you have to be in this one group or the other group. And it's so strong and it's so black and white. And yet, kind of what you said about the people of Utah, when I hang out with a group of people with potentially very mixed views, mostly we share a lot of similar values. And so, like, I think drilling down to what those values are and where we, most, many Americans kind of align and hope for this country, for our families, for our friends, for the people around us, our communities. Like, I think there are so many similarities there. So I really enjoy having those, like, in-person conversations about what those things can and might be. And a lot of times, a lot of the bullshit that I find myself reading online in the morning when I wake up or something like that, a lot of that stuff drops away when I'm actually out with people in the community, even when they're very different than me. And, you know, I'm excited to see how you navigate that in Utah to continue building this team that you have in this movement.
Yeah. And one of the goals is definitely to drive record-breaking youth turnout because, frankly, Utah's never had a candidate like me for the United States Senate. And running as a young person, like, for this position, this system is not designed for someone like me to run. Like, it is designed for someone who's independently wealthy or like the political nepo babies, you know? if you have that, though, it's a lot easier to run. But I'm a political outsider. Like, I've never done this before. I think it's it'll be really cool to establish a proof of this concept and to open the door for a lot more different candidates to run for office, because part of the reason is just we have these like entrenched billionaires and multimillionaires. Like, you need a lot of money to do it, but we're trying to do it differently. It's really hard. Like, it is harder than climbing Everest without my ACL. Like, I'm not gonna lie, it's like doing an Everest every month for a year almost. It's really, really hard. Every hour of my day is like complete, like there's way more things on my schedule than I ever thought I could do in a day. And it's like that every day for like the next 7 months or however many months it is to the election. But also, when you set a big challenge like this, it brings out the helpers, you know, like Mr. Rogers talks about.
Yeah.
And the way that people have stepped up and the amount of support, and it's like the same thing when you go to climb Everest, like people come out of the woodwork to give you that boost, the tailwind, the message of encouragement, whatever it is, you know, whether it's on the mountain or whether it's electronically. And so I think that it really does bring out some of the most beautiful parts of the human spirit. And that part really keeps me going. And just the opportunity that we have to show a different kind of leadership. And there's just so many things we're excited to do with this.
Well, you've proven you can do it in the big mountain, so I'm excited to see you doing it here. I promise we won't take much more of your time because I know how full it is. But what is the next, you know, few weeks, few months? What does it look like?
A big date for us is April 27th, where we'll have the Utah State Democratic Convention. That's where I will become the official nominee for the Democratic Party. And it will be really cool because I'll be one of the youngest Senate nominees in the country. And when I'm elected, I'll be the youngest woman in the United States Senate at 38 years old. So I guess I'll be 39 when I would be sworn into office. But it is, that's a big one. And then we have I have a big trip to DC in early May that I'm really excited about to meet with a lot of other senators and political folks and other organizations. So that will be really exciting. And then we're coming to your neck of the woods on May 4th to do a fundraiser at Palisades. And so I would invite folks to come out and participate and come ski with us or meet us for breakfast. We'll have a morning event on Saturday, May the 4th. So Amy Engerbritzen and Michelle Parker will be there skiing, and it's going to be a really exciting event. So because senators make national decisions, we are doing national fundraising.
Fantastic. Yeah, that was unique. And I didn't know that it was kind of like part of the process was to do kind of national fundraising and events. But I love that you're coming to Tahoe. And unfortunately, I'm going to be walking up a big snowy or maybe not so snowy hill. Otherwise, I'd be here. But yeah, May 4th for everyone in the Tahoe area and Northern California area, the opportunity to ski with Caroline, Amy Engelbretson, and Michelle Parker, have breakfast, learn more about the campaign and donate. I just think it's really exciting.
Yeah, we're really looking. That will probably be one of my favorite events.
Because you get to go skiing. Trail. Wait, this was a question Sam and I had. We were trying to guess, how many days have you skied this winter? Like, do you have FOMO? How is the balance?
I was going to be more subtle and just ask how conditions are in the Wasatch right now.
I want to know.
I've probably skied 100 or more days. I bet I'm at 120 because I do a lot of really short days, and I try to, like, told my campaign staff, I'm like, I don't want anything on my schedule until 11 a.m. most, like, at least 3 days of the week. So I usually have the morning where I have to work out and like get my training in or go skiing. Or sometimes I just need that time to recover and to catch up a little bit on my own work and my personal life and just laundry or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I found that I'm just, the mental load of talking to so many people a day, like in an average day, I'll probably call 50 people and talk to some days I talk to 100 or 200 people. And so I'm still adapting to that load. So I'm very tired. Like I need more time to recover in between. It's weird how those kinds of things can feel like a big workout on your body, like doing a speaking tour, doing 4 events in a day, speaking to people across the state. Like I get an actual tension headache the next day. It's weird. Yep. The same that I would after doing a big route in the mountains or something. So I'm just trying to take all the same kinds of mindsets. Like it really does translate super well. This is a huge mountain to climb. I have a lot stacked against me. It's a David and Goliath, but I've taken on challenges with a low probability of success before, and I've proved people wrong and I've been successful. And so I'm taking all the same things from mountaineering to this Senate race, and I really am excited to see more people like me run for Congress and for public office in the future, because if we love the outdoors and we love America and we love the freedoms and things that we have, the privileges, we all need to do a little bit as much as we can to help protect that for future generations.
Absolutely. It's cool. We talk about, you know, how to make change all the time, but you are actually making change versus just talking about it. So very honorable.
Yeah. And it's like going back to what we talked about at the beginning, you know, how women wait until they're over 100% qualified, whereas men apply for things when they're 60% qualified. Like this is super exciting for me because I think just the skill set that I would bring to the table as Utah's next senator, that it would be really good to have somebody who knows a lot about social media in Congress to help regulate social media companies. Like, I don't know if you guys listened to any of those congressional testimonies where our Congress people were interrogating Mark Zuckerberg and other social media leaders, but it's really clear that we need more tech savvy millennials, Gen Z. We need more young people to step up and run and to help get our country back on the right path. So it's a great opportunity. I'm super psyched about it. And we'll see where it takes us. But I'm hopeful that when I'm elected, I will still be able to sneak in an expedition during the congressional schedule. You know, you have some recesses and things. And so I would be like always trying to tee it up.
Well, now that we know as well, you're still sneaking out for those ski mornings. All of a sudden, maybe there's a whole group of listeners like, oh, maybe I can run for office. It is possible.
For sure. You definitely can.
Before we wrap things up, Caroline, how can people follow your campaign? How can they support your campaign? And how can they follow you personally?
Yes, I would say, I mean, check out our website, caroline4utah.com. If you want to share it with a couple friends, that would be awesome because we need all the support we can get, whether you live in Utah or not. If you can chip in a couple bucks, it will really help us to compete with our competitors, the opponents that are backed by dark money super PACs and that have billionaire friends. We're doing things differently. And so even if it's a couple bucks, it can go a long way to helping us achieve these enormous fundraising goals to run this competitive campaign. Yeah. And just to keep helping us spread the word, follow us on social media, carolineforutah.com. I mean, Caroline for Utah. And if you live in Utah, vote for us in November.
Awesome. Well, we wrap every episode up with two Duffel Shuffle questions. I want to start off by asking for your best Duffel Shuffle story. Something that is a little bit more about the adventure, whether it's, you know, traveling in an airport or on a train or on a boat, where you just, you know, everything wasn't going wrong, but it's one of your favorite, sorry, everything wasn't going right, but it's one of your favorite memories.
I don't know. You guys can always cut this out if you don't like the story.
Oh, I can't wait.
Probably one of my favorite Duffel Shuffle stories was on our way to Tibet to climb Everest. And I think we were in was it Shanghai or Beijing? I can't remember which airport, but we had hidden a bunch of lighters in our 6 pieces of luggage, and they were all hidden in random nooks and crannies so that we could start our stoves with them. And the Chinese security kept putting our bags in and spitting them back out. Like they went in and they came right back out. And we had to take every piece of luggage out to find every single one of our lighters before they would let us take our bags through. And we missed our connecting flight. And we had to spend the night in Taiyuan, not Taiwan, but Taiyuan, which is another city in China that's home to like 7 million people. We had this unexpected layover at the airport, and the airport actually closed. So we had to spend the night outside. And I really had to pee, and there was a fountain right next to us the whole time with this like sound of trickling water. But there was no bathroom because the airport was closed, and there's like cameras everywhere, so you can't pee in the parking lot. And I held my pee for 4.5 hours, made it through the night. I didn't get arrested, and we made it in time to meet the team in Chengdu to get on the flight to Lhasa.
But no lighters.
No lighters.
Every single one of them, all six that were randomly hidden in our bags.
I love that.
If you want, I can find another story.
No, that is great. So perfect. That is exactly what I think of like these completely unexpected moments that are so memorable that you would never like take a beautiful photo of, you know, but it's like, this is what makes an expedition. And that is such a funny story because literally we just did our like group Zoom for Leaving for Everest next week. And one of the things we now talk to clients about is this like incredible ability in local Chinese domestic airports to find every single thing you have hidden, whether it's lighters or lithium batteries or another one. And they will run that bag all day long and all night and the next day until they find it all. And so we're trying to prep our clients for this.
That's really helpful because, the lithium ion batteries too. Like now we have this special roller bag that we put all of our batteries in.
Yep.
And we named it Brock because it's like our baby. And we joked if Rob and I ever had a baby, we'd name it Brock. And Rob's last name is Lee, so it'd be Broccoli. So
Broccoli.
We have this baby Brock with all our electronics. And it's like this 50-pound roller bag that we carry on with us that's like an absolute monster to get in and out of the overhead compartment. But we put all the lithium batteries there and don't try to sneak lighters into China.
I thought you were going to finish that story with peeing in the fountain. And I was like, too. I am here for it. But
no, I didn't want to get arrested in China. Yeah, like
I don't think it would have gone great for you.
Everywhere. I was like, maybe I could put this sarong around my waist and get the pee bottle out and like pee, but there's just no way to do it. So it was very painful. It was hard on my kidneys.
These are skills you will probably not need in the Senate chamber, but you never know.
No, actually, DC is very similar. You have to be able to hold your pee for a really long time. You don't always have access to a bathroom. Yes.
That's great.
All those things will serve me well in the U.S. Senate.
So. Excellent. Okay. And our second Duffle Shuffle question we ask everyone, you know, for this next trip you go on, whether it's to D.C. or to a mountain, what is the very first thing that you put in your duffel bag? Like the most important thing that you just can't be without whenever you travel?
Mine are pretty practical and boring, I would say. My pillow, like I always bring a little pillow with me that I use for like lumbar support or, you know, it's just nice to have that little bit of comfort in case you have an unexpected layover or, you know, being able to sleep well. And then the second thing would be my eye mask. I always bring an eye mask with me so I can create darkness and sleep.
Ooh, love
that's
it.
A good one.
Yes, but they're very boring and practical. I mean, always a Cliff Bar too, so that if I need a snack. Yeah.
It's those things that get us through every day that or allow you to get a good night's sleep so you can actually kick ass the next day. Those are all the types of things that I think make it all work.
Definitely.
Well, Caroline, thank you so much for taking the time. You're a very busy woman right now, and we appreciate the hour and a half that you gave us. We'll be following along your Senate race and wish you all the best.
Thanks so much for having me. Good luck on Everest, and look forward to following all of your adventures as well.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and enjoy skiing out here in Tahoe. And
I'm excited.
And everyone, Caroline, for Utah, find it, follow, and donate if you can. Thanks, Caroline.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to episode 3 of The Duffel Shuffle with Caroline Gleick. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, rate us, and leave us a review. It's incredibly helpful in getting our show out there. We'll be back with episode 4 on May 14th. And until then, we hope you enjoy some fresh air and adventures.